Today's lecture is going to focus specifically on the significance of a topic I think we all know and love, the Little Golden Book series. We are joined by Leonard Marcus, one of the world's leading authorities on children's books and their illustration. His highly acclaimed books about children's literature and the authors and artists who create them include Margaret Weis Brown, Awakened by the Moon, Golden Legacy, How Golden Books Won Children's Hearts, Changed Publishing Forever and Became an American Icon Along the Way, and most recently, Funny Business. I have to say that I've had the privilege of hearing Leonard speak about golden books before, and he completely charmed me. So I hope today, this morning, we can all kind of join in this wonderful sensation and feeling of remembering that first time when we opened golden books, be it with our children, grandchildren, or perhaps ourselves when we were once young. So without further ado, please again, let's join for a warm welcome for Leonard Marcus. Thank you.
Well, good morning. Today, I'm going to be talking about the big phenomenon in American children's books, and that is Little Golden Books. The story of the making of Golden Books starts not in New York, where most publishing stories in America do begin, but in Racine, Wisconsin, around the turn of the last century, about 1910, when German Lutheran immigrants got together in a small town called Racine, which was almost like one of the Silicon Valleys of the industrial era. It was a magnet for inventors and creative people of various kinds, and for very enterprising, ratio alger, up by their bootstraps kinds of people. And this group of young German Americans decided to go into the printing business. And they realized that a good kind of client to have as a printer would be a publishing company. They found a customer for their printing business in Chicago, a publisher of children's books, and they began working together, and the next thing they knew, the publisher went bankrupt, and these people were stuck with a very large inventory of children's books that they were not going to get paid for. So they decided to see if they could sell them. And in those days, five and dime stores were brand new. They were the new big scale way of selling things retail to the entire nation. And they offered these children's books that they had lying around to Kresge's, was one of those five and dime stores, and found that Kresge's could sell them really fast, and they realized, why don't we publish books of our own? Because we can just do the whole thing ourselves. And that was the beginning of the Western Printing Company as a publisher, and 20 years later, they would become one of the partners in the Golden Books. This man, Sam Lowe, was a social worker to begin with. He was sent out to Racine to start a settlement house there. He worked with teenage boys. He told them stories, then he began writing his stories down. And when the Western Printing Company decided they wanted to publish books too, he went over there and presented himself. They decided to print some of his books. We're still not at Golden Books yet, but we're getting there. And he also turned out to be a Cracker Jack salesman with all kinds of really innovative ideas for how to get children's books out to as many people as possible. One of the big themes of the story of Golden Books was a populist or democratic impulse to make children's books available to the most people possible at an affordable price. And this man, Sam Lowe, who no one's heard of these days, was one of the great thinkers behind all the efforts to do that. His first big coup was creating something called Big Little Books, which took material from the newspaper comic strip and reformatted them as little chunky books, maybe measuring 3 or 4 inches on a side, printed on pulp paper, but with these incredible raffish movie poster-like covers that were bound to catch the attention of any self-respecting child walking into a five and dime store. These books sold for a dime, and they sold in quantities of 600,000 in the course of a six-month period. And they began appearing from Racine in 1932. Well, in the very second year, when Sam Lowe saw how these things were doing, he decided to write to the most interesting maker of popular culture of the day, and that was Walt Disney. And he proposed that Western be given the right to print all children's books based on Mickey Mouse, who was then about a five-year-old character, but already wildly popular not only in the U.S., but in places like England and France. So the Big Little Books started featuring the Disney characters by the early 1930s, 1933, 34. Western was based in Racine, and they knew, of course, that most publishing was based in New York. So they decided they needed to have an outpost here. So they set up an office with a very grand artistic-sounding name, the Artists and Writers Guild. Richard Simon and Max Schuster were both graduates of Columbia University in the 1920s. In the 1920s in New York, if you were Jewish, you couldn't get a job at any of the old houses like Harper or Putnam. So they started their own company. Richard Simon had a sign on his desk in the way that Harry Truman had the buck stops here. Richard Simon's sign said, "Give the reader a break." He was very, very interested in making books available to everyone at an affordable price. And the first thing that Simon and Schuster did along those lines was for adults, and that was the creation of pocketbooks, which was a line of paperbacks, both classics and contemporary fiction, which sold from wire racks in places like drugstores and train stations for 25 cents. And that was at a time when the average novel, if you'd gone into Scribner or Brentano's, probably would have sold for $2 or $3 or $4. So it really was democratizing literature for the American people. And now they began to turn their sights on the market for children's books. And that's when the Western people in Racine and Simon and Schuster decided to get together and form a partnership. And they said, we'll only do it if we can do something that's never been done before. And what they decided they would do would be to create illustrated books for young children and get the price down to 25 cents. And again, that was at a time when a picture book was apt to cost 8 times that much. Simon and Schuster had waded into the children's book field, one book at a time. But they had a kind of golden touch. They were known as the Maverick Bad Boys of American publishing. They took out ads in places like the New York Times, comparing Pat the Bunny favorably to For Whom the Bell Tolls, which was then a bestseller for adults. And lo and behold, their book, which as you may know, has all sorts of extra things pasted into it, textures to feel, was very difficult to produce, but that was the kind of challenge they liked to take on. And incidentally, it was rooted in the knowledge of progressive education, because the idea was that very young children learn from experience, including physical contact with things, and they learn from playing, and it was a book that was practically a toy. So that was very characteristic of Simon and Schuster's venturesome spirit. They also published this book, Madeline, and Madeline is very much in the same, cut from the same cloth as Curious George, another mischief maker and someone who a child would kind of, you know, identify with in ways that teachers and moralists of one kind or another might feel uncomfortable with. Another factor in the background of making golden books was something that was going on in France in the 1930s. There was a man whose last name was Fauché, who had a background in progressive education there, and he began to make these beautifully illustrated picture books for young children under the umbrella name the Père Castor books. And a man from France named Georges Duplay joined the people at Simon and Schuster and said, why don't we try to do something just like what's going on in Paris right now? And that fed the impulse to create something that very soon became Golden Books. As I said, they came out in 1942, which might not have seemed like a good time to start any sort of business, considering that America was at war, the world was at war, paper and other basic commodities and goods were being rationed. Luckily, or fortunately, the Western Printing Company was making all the maps for the U.S. government, for these soldiers, as well as playing cards and other things. So they had an enormous quantity of paper at their disposal, and that really helped them. Plus, Eleanor Roosevelt, the First Lady, in her newspaper column, was recommending, urging mothers with their young children at home to read to them at night, to make them feel like the world would go on. And here along came Golden Books at 25 cents a piece, sold at five and dime stores and off racks in just the same way that the pocketbooks had been sold, small towns as well as big cities. So Golden Books were everywhere right from the start. You know, it was just what was needed to keep children feeling that life was still okay. The titles, the subjects of these books were all pretty generic. They were things that people could be counted on to recognize or to just know children should have, like an alphabet book or nursery rhyme book and so on. Everything about them was calculated to have widespread appeal. Children quickly glommed onto golden spines. And interestingly, the author's name was never on the cover. It was all about Golden Books as a kind of entity in a world, something bigger. Each book was bigger than itself. And people readily kind of bought into that fantasy and wanted to have all the books at home. Now, because the books were so inexpensive, the librarians, who were the tastemakers and critics of the day, headed by the woman at New York Public Library, Ann Carroll Moore, were very skeptical. They saw this as an example of Henry Ford-style mass production being applied to the world of children's books. How could anything that cheap be any good? And so the Golden Books people countered those criticisms or anticipated criticisms by hiring experts to put their seal of approval on what they were doing. And this is the one you've probably heard of if you've ever looked at a Golden Book, Mary Read, PhD, whose endorsement appears on the inside front cover of every little Golden Book going back to 1942. She was a teacher at Teachers College Columbia, not all that far from here, a real firecracker. She was interested in getting children to really love books. The reading table that many children have grown up with in their classrooms is credited to her. She had this idea that children should be free to move around their classroom at various times during the day and to sort of choose a book of their own rather than only read assigned things. That's the kind of thinking that she had. So she was a very good person to be overseeing this project. And there were many other people, in fact, who had progressive education backgrounds. Tibor Gergely, Hungarian Jew, who also fled to New York because of the war. He had also been a painter in Hungary, but found no interest in his dark expressionist canvases when he got to New York. He was a very enterprising fellow. Shortly after arriving here in 1941, he began doing New Yorker covers and met the people at Golden Books who were thrilled to have him, and he became their most prolific illustrator. He had very left-wing political views and was able actually to express them in his Golden Books, which is kind of wonderful, without anybody knowing it. He would always be assigned stories about working class people. And this is a book called The Happy Man and His Dump Truck. So he was always showing the honor and dignity of labor, as well as lots of other things, the joy of life, for example. And he did Little Toot, which was famously commented on in the 60s by David Reisman, the sociologist, as a kind of fable for modern times, a story about what it means to be an individual in society and whether it's a good thing to go off the track as an individual or whether it's better to stay on track with the group. Gustav Tengren, who was a Swedish immigrant, another one of the great Golden Books illustrators, not Jewish as it happens. He looks a little bit like John Barrymore, I think, and very much saw himself in that role as a kind of matinee idol illustrator. He was the illustrator of The Pokey Little Puppy and many other books. And this is Lucy Mitchell. She was the founder of the Bank Street College of Education. She was very interested in language development, and that led to an interest in children's books on her part, and to questioning everything about what is best for children. She wanted to get away from once upon a time stories for young children and give them what might be called modern books for modern children, stories about their own everyday lives and all the fascinating things that children living in the industrial, urban 1920s and 30s would have found relevant and interesting to themselves. So first she wrote her own book in the 20s. And then in the 40s, when Golden Books came along, she saw a great opportunity to put this new kind of book, this new modern kind of children's book, out into the world. Because Golden Books were sold by the hundreds of thousands. They were everywhere. And this one, The Taxi That Hurried, was one of the ones that she co-authored, features a taxi driver. And it's all about a parent who melts down in the back of a cab when they get caught in a traffic jam. And the child sitting next to the mother gets to kind of enjoy seeing his mother, act less than dignified. Very progressive education impulse, to put children and adults on the same level, demystify adulthood, and also to show you a lot about how the modern world really works. How does our food get to us? This is a book about what happens on a farm and the whole process of not only growing things, but also bringing those growing things to people. Another book by Lucy Mitchell, Golden Book. very much in the vein of progressive education, which was about learning by doing and understanding how things work, how they connect with each other. Lucy Mitchell liked to talk about relationship thinking, which was the opposite of rote learning. Not just a bunch of facts, but how do all the facts connect? How do you connect the dots? And this was her, Mr. Mitchell's prize student at Bank Street, Margaret Weiss Brown, looking also like a kind of movie star, I think. Photographed for Life magazine by Philippe Halsman in 1946, and writing with a feather pen. And she learned at Bank Street to how to focus in on stories, writing for stories for very young children. Took off like a rocket, and like her teacher, Lucy Mitchell, saw Golden Books, even though they were considered down market and were never going to win a big prize, she saw it as a great chance to reach lots of kids with books. And so she and her best friend at Bank Street, Edith Hurd, who was the wife of the man who illustrated Goodnight Moon, would get together from time to time and write what they called their little civics books as Golden Books for children. This one was about what happens when you write a letter and mail it. Where does it go? Who are the people involved? Modes of transportation. All kinds of stuff comes into this. Again, Dibor Gurgley is the illustrator. A very Eastern European little boy there, I think, writing a letter to his grandmother who lives across country. And you get to follow the path of that letter right into his grandmother's hands. It's a really charming story. There's one of the many foreign editions of Little Golden Books, which began to appear after the war was over. The baby boom here created a bigger and bigger market for Golden Books, but also in Europe and Japan, for that matter. And Western had this close relationship with the U.S. government. They were making all the maps during the war. After the war, they were invited to be part of the Marshall Plan. They went to Italy, which had been bombed out, and reconstituted the Italian printing and publishing industries. And pretty soon, Golden Books were being sold all over the world. Again, Golden Books as marketers, they did this little book about what it's like to be a policeman, and they got the New York City Police Department to put a copy of the book in the little kit that every rookie cop got after graduating from the academy. So you got your pistol, you got your badge, and you got a copy of the Little Fat Policeman. And this is Richard Scarry, American from Boston, surpassed Dr. Seuss at one point as the most popular illustrator for children in the world. His father owned a department store in Boston, wanted him to go into the business, familiar story. He wanted to draw instead. His father said, if you do, you'll end up eating spaghetti and being unhappy for the rest of your life. But here he is at his ski chalet, laughing, I guess, at the twist of fate that brought him there. He produced many popular books. This is from the most popular of all published by Golden Books in the first 30 or so years of his career. Richard Scarry's best word book ever. This was not the kind of book that was going to win a Caldecott Medal either. You know, the critics thought it was very busy looking, a little too cutesy. But progressive educators loved this book because it was the embodiment of relationship thinking. Instead of just laying out word after word in alphabetical order, it grouped objects and things and experiences in a way which helped young children understand how the world, their world, really worked. And it was published all around the world. This is Five Little Firemen, written by Margaret Weiss Brown, illustrated by our friend Dibor Gurgley. This is the Dutch edition. It became very popular in the Netherlands after World War II. I think it was read as a kind of symbolically as a story from America about the Americans who came and liberated the Dutch from the Nazi occupation, and it remains the most popular little golden book in the Netherlands to this day. They're very, very popular in that country there, and I guess maybe France and Japan. This was the Golden Encyclopedia, one of the ultimate efforts to give the reader a break. 16 volumes, $1 a piece, sold at supermarkets at a time when the World Book probably sold for about 200. Chance for a child at home to have a complete reference library for use in their homework. In the 60s was a time, as we all remember, I'm sure, of great social change in America, greater awareness of how complex our society is. Children's books had done very little up until that time to recognize the fact that we live in a multicultural and multiracial society. Whitney Young wrote an article that was nationally syndicated criticizing children's books for being all white, Golden Books being the most widely distributed were the principal target of his criticism. One of the ways that Golden Books responded, they redid some of the illustrations and put black children. They also found artists who could address the situation right from the start in new books. We've just talked about new awareness of racial issues, and here gender issues. This is the kind of thing that people were beginning to think about and to say, well, if so many children are seeing these stories, maybe their ideas about themselves and their future really are being shaped by them, so we ought to think about it a little more carefully. This is a cartoon that appeared in The New Yorker a number of years ago. The caption reads, you can see that it's a father, mother, and little girl going into the grand entranceway of the Library of Congress in Washington. And the father, their father knows best father, turns to his little girl and says, just think, every book that's ever been published in the United States is right here in the Library of Congress. And the little girl looks up at him and says, even the pokey little puppy? So that's the end of my talk. And thank you very much for listening.